Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we are offering a free sample PDF of a recent Barnes Review issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. If you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, www.barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit www.barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550, White Plains, Maryland, 20695. Hey, everyone. Today, I'm joined by Malcolm Shayun, a freelance writer who lives in Uppsala, Sweden. So, Malcolm, Barnes Review's listeners are very likely not acquainted with your work. Nevertheless, I'm of the view that your body of work at places such as Unheard, Compact Magazine previously, and other outlets offer fresh perspectives on political affairs. Could you give our audience a brief rundown of your bio and the current work you do?
Well, I mean, I'm basically sort of an essayist, sort of a political commentator, social critic, and that stuff. And I started writing about the US in, I want to say, 2020. Like, I was around, I mostly wrote in Swedish before that, actually, but I sort of moved over talking about America and, like, you know, the fate of the left in America back when there still was one and so on. And then over time, like, I sort of came into a very weird niche where I kind of realized at some point that, you know, I can't really, as an outsider, try to understand America without understanding the U.S. military as like a human institution, because most people who tend to focus on the U.S. military, they just like look at pictures of aircraft carriers or attack helicopters or whatever. And I don't really find that particularly interesting or, you know, meaningful. So I started writing about the military, and I had like this Twitter account where people started sending me, like people inside the military started sending me like a lot of anecdotes, a lot of links and so on. So I eventually became sort of my beat, in a sense, like journalistically. And now I'm kind of, you know, invited to Washington, D.C., like to consult on some stuff. And I'm actually going in roughly 6 weeks. I'm going back to the U.S., and we'll see if Elbridge Colby actually buys me that lunch he promised me last time.
Interesting. Yeah, and Elbridge Colby, he has a position in the Trump administration, if I'm not mistaken. Isn't he in the Defense Department right now?
Yes, he is the, I think, like the, oh man, like what's the title? Like it's an undersecretary for policy, I think. So he's sort of a deputy to the incoming Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth.
Yeah, he's the undersecretary for of defense for policy, yes, for the Trump administration. This ties into one of my first question here, because here's like the overall picture of what we see happening worldwide. Supply chains are breaking down. The U.S., in a ham-fisted way, is nearshoring and reshoring its industry. And this is all taking place against the backdrop of the changing of borders that we're seeing with Russia's takeover of Crimea and parts of eastern Ukraine. Then you have all this Greenland annexation talk, Canada becoming the 51st state, the renaming of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Is it just me, or are we going through a major breakdown of the so-called rules-based international order?
Oh, yes. I mean, definitely. But I do think that, like, this Greenland stuff or the Canada stuff, it's not really about, like, the breakdown of the rules-based international order. Like, that thing broke down, with Russia and Ukraine, and then with the conflict in the Middle East, and that it's completely dead. I think that, like, the Greenland stuff is just, like, this is kind of the life flashing before your eyes as you die moment for the American empire itself. Because if you think about, like, Greenland annexation here, to what end? Like, America has 5 icebreakers. Finland has 11, you know, the military superpower of Sweden with its, like, 4,000 soldiers or whatever. Like, Sweden has 7 icebreakers. It has more icebreakers than the U.S., which is kind of something you need if you want to be mucking about up in the Arctic. Like, America's icebreakers are just falling apart, and the U.S. barely knows how to make them anymore because it, like its shipbuilding industry is collapsing. And if you consider the relationship with Denmark, like, if you want to open a mine on Greenland, all you have to do is ask, and they'll say, sure, here's your mining permit. If you want to open a military base, all you have to do is ask, and the Danes will say, fine, open a base. Like, there is a sense in which, for the last 40 years or something, America's only really picked fights, like wars and so on, with enemies that basically can't fight back, which is why you had the bombing campaign of, like, all of NATO versus the nation of Serbia. And then when that bombing campaign didn't go very well and the Serbian army actually, like, resisted, the Americans kind of got into a panic and they called Boris Yeltsin and they said, like, you have to convince these guys to surrender. Like, otherwise, like, we're going to be embarrassed. And Yeltsin complied. And then you had, you know, the invasion of Iraq. You had the invasion of Afghanistan. Neither country could fight back effectively. I think you have to understand the Greenland stuff not as, oh my God, we really need to open a mine. Oh my God, we really need a military base. No, this is like, we need to show the world that we're the boss. And at this point, you can only really, like, pick a fight with a NATO ally that you consciously, like, asked to demilitarize itself. You know, sell all of its howitzers, all of its airplanes, and so on to Ukraine. This is the schoolyard bully, like, beating up the corpse of a rat or something to show the rest of the world that, like, oh my God, this guy's so strong. So it's not a good sign for the American empire. Like, it's much less about Greenland. It's much more about, like, this is sort of the opponent that you can pick a fight with without risking, you know, them kicking your ass back. Because the U.S. actually picked the fight with Yemen, for example, one of the poorest countries in the world. That did not go very well. The Yemen military blockaded, like, one of the most important trade routes in the entire world for more than a year. The U.S. sent, like, several carriers, and, like, they couldn't break the blockade.
One thing I've noticed here with the Greenland thing is that the U.S. empire really doesn't know how to proverbially take the L, like, admit that they lost in a geopolitical conflict such as the Russo-Ukrainian war, where they have used Ukraine as a proxy against Russia. And now they're just scrambling to get, like, a consolation prize. Despite all the talk you hear from, like, the Trump administration about how it wants to dial down tensions in Russia, Do you think they could actually achieve a negotiated settlement with Russia? Because I'm starting to think that the Russians are just saying this, like, screw that. We're just going to, like, settle this in the battlefield. We've done no negotiation thing for the past few decades about security concerns, and the Americans just break all their agreements. So we're going to settle it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. Like, the U.S. is just going to eventually move away from this, like it does with all conflicts. The problem in this case is just that, like with Afghanistan, you can just say, oh yeah, we could have won, but we didn't really care because, like, you're not a real opponent anyway. Like with Russia, like they're going to be basically handing the West like terms of surrender, and we're going to be forced to, you know, put our names on the dotted line at some point. And at that point, like, everyone is going to try, but it's going to be much harder to say, oh no, like, we could have won this. But yeah, I don't really think there any, like, there's really nothing to negotiate about, because what the US wants here is something that the rest of the world can't give it, which is, you know, assurances that America isn't slipping, that it's still the same empire it always was. Like, nobody has the power to sort of make that a reality, because the U.S. is collapsing. Like, the empire is falling apart. The military is barely functional. And like, so many resources today go to, like, what people need to understand, and this might seem controversial, but it really isn't a secret inside Washington. Like, I can say that from, you know, firsthand experience. People need to understand that the U.S. military today is more of a ideological creation, like a than the East German army, you know, 6 months before the East German army stopped existing. Like, it's way more ideological than the North Korean military, the Chinese military, and the Russian military put together. So what you're seeing today, and this is a commonly, like, you know, they wrote about this in the New York Times, and the New York Times was not the first to acknowledge this either. But, like, you have all of these presence missions in Eastern Europe that are designed to show the world that the U.S. military, like, can respond in within 24 hours or whatever. Like, you can't mess with us. At this point, like, there's so few people left to carry out these exercises that, like, if you're a unit commander, you do shit like you send over red flagged soldiers, and this is a term denoting, like, people with acute suicidal ideation. Soldiers on really heavy medication who are not authorized to be anywhere near a loaded firearm, because if they get close to a loaded firearm, there's like a 50% chance they'll blow their own brains out or just take that gun, go to the mess hall, and start mowing down other soldiers in the middle of eating. They're sending those people over for like 12 hours to Romania or Poland. And then, you know, once they touch down, they're on the tarmac for 10 hours or something. And then they're immediately sent back to the United States. Why? Because for those 12 hours, like, those are the 12 hours that count for filing readiness reports. So you send over all of these suicidal, like, useless soldiers, and then say, look, we had only like 12% of our total force strength missing. Like, we're basically at full strength. But it's all just a Potemkin village. It's all just a sham. And that airplane ticket, that airfare, it costs money. Like, this is just a waste of resources. But it's all designed to keep up the illusion, mostly for consumption within, like, you know, the senile political leadership class in the United States.
That's what it's looking like more and more. And when you piece together a lot of this huffing and puffing about Greenland and Canada, I get the vague impression that in a really roundabout way, the Trump administration may lead to the unraveling of NATO, not to mention also with Turkey as well, becoming a wild card. Like, imagine a scenario where in the Middle East that Turkey somehow ends up butting heads with Israel, like, and Article 5 is, like, somehow invoked. that would be one of the most awkward situations where NATO countries will have to come to the defense of Turkey, a NATO member, against like Israel. Do you think, like, in the next decade that NATO will completely unravel?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. For the simple reason that the U.S. is unraveling. Like, the U.S., the next decade, so we're talking, like, out to 2045. Anyone who thinks that the U.S. empire is going to be a thing in 2045, boy, howdy, do I have an aircraft carrier to sell them. And I'm only half joking about that, because one of the things that happened when the USSR collapsed was that for a short moment, like Pepsi, like the soft drink company, became the owners of like the fourth biggest naval, like the Navy in the world. They had a bunch of missile cruisers and attack submarines and stuff like that, like Pepsi had, because the USSR was completely broke. So for certain loans, I think, you know, buying Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola or whatever to importing it into Russia, they actually put up a bunch of their old naval vessels they couldn't afford to maintain anymore as collateral. And then Pepsi came into possession of said collateral. I think they sailed it to Norway for shipbreakers there, so they could, you know, basically be made whole through the scrap value of the Red Navy. That shit is going to happen in the U.S. And, like, the U.S. Navy can barely maintain its fleet of vessels. It can't really repair stuff that's happening from, you know, like, just peacetime wear and tear. The idea that you could take a navy that can't actually repair, like, normal peacetime accidents and go to war against China and somehow prevail, it's just a fantasy. Like, the moment the ship got damaged even slightly, like, that ship would be put out of action permanently, because there's no dry dock space. So all of this is just a roundabout way of saying, like, all of these systems that depend on the U.S. dollar, the U.S. security guarantee, all of that is going away, and it's going away fairly soon. And I do agree with you that Trump is probably the person who will really, like, he is going to be an even sort of less competent Gorbachev for the U.S. here.
Let's shift our focus domestically with respect to Trump, because I think that what you're seeing in every facet of U.S. politics is just breakdown, factional infighting, which is the hallmark of a declining polity, no matter how you slice it. And you wrote one piece for Unheard titled, quote, "MAGA's divisions can't be healed. The H-1B row is only the start," end quote. You're talking about the whole H-1B visa controversy that kicked off in December. How do you think that this whole immigration kerfuffle is going to pan out within the MAGA sphere, if you will? And is it a sign of just that, like, the Republican Party is going to go through, like, a massive implosion?
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing this, the continuation of the whole H-1B, like, Vivek Elon fight. You had Chris Rufo and a bunch of others basically going on about how young people today are essentially entitled because the economy is doing great, the U.S. has full employment, and you could just, you know, start working at Panda Express as a manager, earning 70K a year. And 70K a year, that's a good salary. Like, why do all of these entitled young people feel like they're too good to, you know, work a normal, ordinary job? Obviously, this is an overdetermined discussion, because the people saying, yeah, I don't want to work at Panda Express, some of them might be, you know, they have ideas of, like, racial caste eugenicists or whatever. Like, But a lot of the case, it's like, okay, I went to college, I paid $200K to get my degree in, you know, computer science. And now you're telling me to work a fast food job because H-1B immigration has replaced me. No thanks, bro. And people are very circumspect about that point where it's like, you know, the Manhattan Institute, for example, has a very clear institutional position, which is we need to basically uncap the H-1B visa and make it so like Americans should be competing against the entire world for white collar work. And so you get this sense, and this is actually quite fascinating. If you take an individual like Matt Walsh, who is, he's at like the Daily Wire, it's called, right?
Yes, Daily Wire, yes.
Yeah, Matt Walsh is at the Daily Wire. And he's out there at this point saying, like, inflation is just kind of an overblown meme. Like, yeah, there's some inflation, but it's really not that bad. It's certainly not something that you should say cited as a reason for why you're not doing well in life. If you're not doing well, it's your own fault. Okay, well, 2 months ago, you know, 60, 65 days ago, Matt Walsh was saying stuff like, inflation is destroying America, like Biden's economy is horrible, like we can't even afford food for our babies. That's the wording he used, like we can't even afford food for our babies because of inflation ruining us. And it's like, okay, did Biden build back better in the last 59 days of his administration? What's going on here? Like, Trump hasn't assumed office yet. And suddenly, like, the awful, horrible, terrible, no good Biden economy is actually really good.
Yeah, that's actually funny you mentioned that. Weird.
And it's like, yeah, okay, either this is some sort of, I don't know, like, hive mind instructing people to change their tune for whatever reason, or maybe people are just subconsciously thinking that they really have to lower expectations. But like all of this talk about like fixing the economy, like it's just gone. It's completely gone. At this point, Biden built back better, the entire thing, like best president ever, best economy ever. We love Joe Biden, folks, old Scranton Joe. Of course, nobody says that, but like that's the sort of like logical conclusion one has to draw. And yeah, there's nothing. What do you mean fixed economy? There's nothing to fix. Everything is great. Like you're living in the best of all possible worlds. You know, imagine what that says about like your own political ambitions when you start, you know, dick riding a guy who is well on his way to entering the annals of history as perhaps the worst president America has ever had. And problem? What problem? Like, the economy is great.
I think you're onto something in one of your latter points you raise about how the people like Matt Walsh, they're part of this new alternative conservative media sphere that really, when you look at it, the difference between them and, say, like the old Buckleyite types is that they're just using new media and new technology to convey what is otherwise like a regime gatekeeping mechanism. They're just priming the population for decline in their like living standards. Because if you look at like the work of like John Williams of Shadow Stats, he has like said that the government has played around with CPI and inflation indices numbers for the past 50 or so years to downplay inflation. And never mind also the emergence of like shrinkflation as well, where you'll see like, say, for example, like a Big Mac or whatever, it'll still cost like $4, but it's like 400 to like 600 calories less, and there's like much less protein in it, and also just lower quality ingredients too that's not taken into account. So it's essentially, you're actually still paying an exorbitant price for a good of diminished quality, And that's where a lot of the stuff is not captured well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like there is obviously like a lot of effort being invested into essentially betraying the own base here. And it's not hard to see why this is happening, because like the US is completely broke. And the talk about like bringing in infinite H-1B Indians and so on, and like America is a propositional nation. It's like when these fucking boomers say that stuff, like the basic logical conclusion one has to draw is that everyone in Sweden is more of an American than like every American. Why? Because if you adjust for the currency and differences in cost of living, like people in Sweden work for, like if you work at a McDonald's in Sweden, you earn less money than a person working at a McDonald's in the US. Like that does not necessarily mean like a lower living standard, because you are going to pay significantly less for rent, for example, or you can actually own an apartment in Sweden on a McDonald's job. Like that's not impossible. But even with that said, like you earn less money, and what is being an American about? It's working hard for low pay. So everyone in Sweden is actually an American. And, you know, every person born in America, like you should deport them to Greenland or whatever, because they're obviously like not real Americans compared to a person in Bangladesh or India or whatever who's willing to work 80 hours a week. But a lot of this, I think, is just making a virtue out of necessity. Like if you're going to see this collapse in living standards, as a boomer, you're probably more interested in saying, well, it's a good thing and it's your own fault, rather than, oh no, it's a really bad thing and it's actually my generation's fault.
I want to also talk about, because of the H-1B visa, this is downstream of Elon Musk's entry into this political scene, because this guy is on... unapologetic legal immigration booster par excellence.
Yeah.
Like he'll go on X, Twitter, and talk about how we need to stop like illegal immigration. That's fine and dandy. But then he's just saying, but we need to like bring in so-called skilled labor from all over the global South, which is just going to obviously benefit his bottom line, but create a huge, dislocation and displacement of American labor from the lower middle class, even to some professional managerial class, which I think could create revolutionary conditions, because it's those people in the middle classes, especially the aspiring elites, those are the type of people that will actually go the extra mile to rile up unrest and even kick off a revolution. And this goes to one of your pieces that you wrote for Unheard that's titled What Revolutionary France Can Teach Elon Musk. And one of your strong suits, Malcolm, is how you can draw like parallels from history and apply them into the present. And what can Musk learn from this tumultuous epoch of world history?
Yeah, I mean, the French Revolution basically had Elon Musk, except actually competent and, you know, less of a horse tranquilizer addict, but in the form of the Swiss banker Jacques Necker. And basically he had this sort of rock star reputation, like this is the guy, he's like this super smart technocrat, we should let him fix what's wrong with France. That didn't go so well, because I mean Necker was a pretty good banker, but you don't really, like there wasn't one weird magic trick to fixing like a politically deadlocked system that was also bankrupt and just like not in line with what was needed at the time. But Elon Musk is kind of like the first time as strategy, the second time as farce, because like what's what's Elon Musk doing right now as we record this? He's actually involved in a fucking like scandal, quote unquote, where he's been juicing his gamer bona fides. Basically, there's a new game called Path of Exile 2 that was released into beta a month ago, roughly. And he has one of the most top-ranked characters in that game. And he's like, yeah, dude, I'm so awesome. I manage a lot of companies. I'm the richest guy in the world. And I also have like a level 94 warrior in Path of Exile 2. And then it turns out that like, no, he just paid some dude or several dudes to level his warrior to like max level or whatever. And at one point he actually streamed himself playing it, and it was clear like nobody knows, like he didn't know how to play the game. And now like there's this big drama bomb where he's like removing the blue check from YouTubers, leaking like DMs he's had with other Path of Exile players to show that no, like they're lying. He even got his fucking like ex-girlfriend Grimes to chime in and say, no, Elon Musk really is a great gamer. Like he used to be like the super great druid player in Diablo 2. And it's like, what the fuck, man? Like, why is like, okay, if this is the hope of America, like this guy is going to come in and fix the government through the Department of Government Efficiency, which he only named that because it's haha, it's a funny reference to a shitty like Ponzi scheme electronic coin, shit coin called Doge, which itself is just like a meme based on a photogenic like Japanese Shiba Inu dog. It's so tawdry, like it's so stupid, but like this entire hype around him, I do think that like this is a natural stage in a regime that is basically almost ready to crash and burn. Like you always have these weird figures, like, you know, you had Rasputin in Russia before the revolution, you had Nicker in France before the revolution. Like everyone seems to want some sort of shaman or witch doctor when they encounter a system that is so broken that reforms really genuinely seems impossible. But I mean, if Elon Musk actually spent about as much time figuring out like how to fix the budget deficit of the United States as he's spending arguing with a guy called Asmongold about a video game.
Yeah.
Maybe America would have a shot, but like, no, that's not about to happen. So
now, as far as revolutionary moments are concerned, one theme I've noticed across multiple of your articles and even podcast appearances over the year is your coverage of the concept of elite overproduction. It's apparently a fixture of the present crisis era. Could you go into more detail about what exactly that entails and why it remains relevant in the years to come?
Oh, yeah. I mean, elite overproduction is basically, you know, it's kind of what it says on the tin. There's a guy named Peter Turchin who is kind of a, I wouldn't say he's a historian. He has this like weird interdisciplinary thing, which I think he calls cliodynamics, where it's like we're trying to apply a scientific model based on, I think, like the reproduction pattern of beetles or whatever, or, you know, like organisms in general in nature to human societies. But the actual sort of theory of elite overproduction is generally just that a society will generate a lot of people who, and elites here is not understood as people who are really smart. It's like if you think about nobility, for example, If you're a noble and you have like you're in the German tradition, for example, in the 14th century, like every son has to inherit some land so he can be a noble, kind of like you. So he needs a certain amount of land. He needs enough for a manor house. He needs enough serfs to, you know, pay him taxes so he can have all of these feasts and so on. If you have five sons, you have to split the land, you know, into five chunks. And so that tends to create a massive problem, because the ability of like a noble family to have a bunch of sons is way in excess of their ability to, you know, go out and conquer new land in general. And because every other family they could conquer new land from also has a bunch of soldiers and also has a bunch of sons, like you tend to see a situation where there's a lot of like excess sons of the nobility. One of the ways this was solved in you know, the actual Middle Ages was through crusades, where hopefully these people would die en route to the Holy Land or to the Baltics or whatever, and then, you know, problem solved. Or they'd arrived and they die over there, problem solved again. Or they'd, you know, actually win and take a bunch of land from the pagans or the Muslims, and, you know, they could be elites in the kingdom of Jerusalem. And obviously, like, we don't really solve these things through like private wars and personal conquest, but you still have the same problem where it's like society will generate more and more sort of people with a claim to having a like elite lifestyle, but generally speaking, that society's ability to actually deliver the living standard the elite has come to accept will lag behind the amount of claims. And that's clearly happening inside the US today, I would say.
Do you see the H-1B visa, an expansion of legal migration, just taking that elite overproduction process to like accelerationist levels?
Oh yeah, I mean, definitely. And this is one of the things, like, there's obviously kind of a quote-unquote racist undertone to a lot of this stuff, where it's like, yeah, Indians, they don't know how to use toilets, we really hate Indians, blah, blah, blah. I think that in some sense, yeah, like, a lot of that is kind of crude, but in another sense, it speaks to something real, which has less to do with, you know, open street defecation in Mumbai or whatever, much more to do with the fact that one thing where it's kind of like anecdata at this point is, once you get all of these H-1B applicants, because this is like if you're an H-1B worker, you are basically an indentured servant for 5 years, after which you can actually apply for a green card. And once you have a green card, you can stay in the US and you can then, you can actually quit your job without being sent back. Well, once these people actually achieve some sort of position of authority or hiring, you know, like privileges, they will tend to hire their own kind. So other people from India, essentially, and they will tend to disfavor Americans. Why would that happen? Well, I mean, there's only so many elite positions to go around, and India produces far more of these wannabe elites than can be absorbed by India. So they have to go somewhere. And so that somewhere is just going to the US and sort of actually extirpating Americans from the American tech sector. So clearly, like, this isn't really like a fight about culture so much as it is a fight about a very limited amount of chairs in the game of musical chairs that's taking place.
That's also the way I see it, that it is really a case of people demonstrating not only identitarian concerns, but also socioeconomic concerns of one tribe losing its power to this incoming tribe that the elites have like imported to the U.S. That's naturally going to create tension. And that's something we have seen across civilization since time immemorial. The last few weeks, though, it seems that things are really coming to a head in the U.S. The Southern California fires are just like the latest episode of breakdown that we're seeing in the United States. And then this is one of the most emblematic regions, in my opinion, because the settlement and development of LA as one of the US's prestige cities, it marked a turning point in US history, given its cultural cachet of being home to Hollywood and all of that. But now you've been seeing a really big exodus of people from LA and broader California in general to other states. And with this wildfire, it seems like this is like a watershed moment where the proverbial torch is being passed from LA to like some other city in the Sun Belt, whether it's like Houston, Dallas, Austin. But yes, what do you make of this development in Southern California, and what does it say about really with U.S. infrastructure in the decades to come?
Yeah, I think that when people talk about this wildfire in California being this is a crisis of climate change, I just shake my head, because it just goes to show that people really haven't been thinking about what climate change is and what it isn't. So generally speaking, the political debate about climate change is kind of like a time waster. It's empty calories, because the only thing that's ever being discussed is does human behavior contribute to climate change or not? And it's that's a completely irrelevant question, because climate change without human behavior is in any event way, 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 way bigger than climate change caused by human behavior could ever possibly theoretically be. So, 10,000 years ago, when most of Europe was already settled and had been settled for thousands of years, you could walk from Denmark to, this where London is today, in a straight line from Denmark to London without ever getting your feet wet, because it was just, open ground all the way. There was no, what's today called the Dogger Bank didn't exist, because the sea level was 120 meters below where it is today. And if you dig in the surface of Antarctica, you will find fossilized remains of, the Antarctican rainforest, which existed some X amount of millions of years ago. So climate change, it's just a thing. It happens. That's why the thing that preceded the current sort of Holocene or interglacial period, the period between the ice ages, was an ice age. The problem in California is that a bunch of fires have come, probably caused by, changing climate over time, fine. And now that they've destroyed 15,000 homes or whatever, it turns out nobody can afford insurance. The lack of affordability of insurance here is the actual problem facing humans. And the reason they can't afford insurance, imagine if I waved a magic wand and that magic wand had the power to make sure that properties in California. So, you're a teacher, you're living in a small, three bedroom or two bedroom, condo, whatever, close to Los Angeles. You're a teacher working in Los Angeles. Okay. Today that condo costs $4 million, but I waved a magic wand and suddenly the market price of the house you're living in is $200,000. With my magic wand, there would not be a massive crisis in California because, like, you know, that teacher in LA can afford a 200K home, no problem. Like, you know, getting a mortgage, even with these high interest rates for a home that costs 200K, no big deal. Paying fire insurance on a property valued at 200K, that's not impossible. Even with like 10 times worse climate change than today, it's probably going to be affordable for that teacher. But California has this weird system where it's like, everyone is house rich. Everyone is like a millionaire because they have a house that's valued at, you know, X amount of millions of dollars. Nobody can afford to sell the house because then they'll have to buy a new one. And nobody can afford the mortgage payments for a new one. So like home sales have completely collapsed. Nobody can afford to insure the value of their home. Nobody can afford to pay property taxes on the real value of their home, which is why, you know, it's a sort of a necessity for California to never update their home valuations to make sure that, like, you're paying property taxes on what that house was worth 40 years ago, not what it's worth today. Because if you have to do that, well, you're out on the street. Like, you have this trap for California where it's like everyone is rich, but in fact, like, this is just a massive crisis of affordability. All of the insurance companies have looked at the prices and they've said, like, we can't insure this. There's no fucking way. Like, we're walking away. The state is now on the hook for, I don't know, like $150 billion, $200 billion of damages. And it has like $700 million in the bank. So, like, the state is going to go bankrupt over this. And all of this is to say that, like, what California sort of symbolizes here is not climate change, but a model in which the line must always go up. Like, home prices must always go up because that makes me rich. It doesn't really matter that it's, you know, completely impossible to have any sort of middle-class existence anymore because of these insane prices. Like, they have to increase. And now, like, what do you even do to fix this with all of these destroyed buildings? Like, you can't insure them ever again. Like, that's impossible. So, like, is the U.S. government going to be on the hook for, like, I don't know, like a couple of trillion in property values? Like, just this massive subsidy to the Californian housing market? No, that's not going to work. Nobody's going to accept that. But what if house prices fall? Okay, that's great in theory, but if they do, a bunch of banks are going to go bust, and then a bunch of companies are going to go bust because they've all been invested into this line must go up paradigm. So you're going to have a new Great Depression in that case. So, like, the U.S., like, the entire model where the U.S. just moved its factories abroad, all of its manufacturing, all of its like making of stuff, and moved over to an economy where everyone gets richer because the line goes up. Well, everyone got richer in California until the fire came, and now the entire state is bankrupt, and everyone who has had their home destroyed is going to be homeless.
Pretty crazy stuff. But one of the things that I've noticed, despite so many aspects of the American political order collapsing, is that there are still people that are engaging in just massive amounts of coke or just dealing out copium. And one of the most notable copium dealers, just to name them, is that geopolitical strategist, Peter Zeihan, that used to be associated with Stratfor. And Stratfor is actually based where I'm at in Austin. And he goes with the typical analysis that the U.S. will be fine in this deglobalized world thanks to the large network of navigable rivers it has, the fact that it has two geopolitical moats in the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Oceans, and then the continental nature of its economy that doesn't allow it to be as dependent on trade. But I think that this guy's just seeing things in like a really different manner. Where do you think the, people like Zion go wrong in their analysis of how the U.S. is going to look like in this new order?
I mean, the problem with Zion ultimately is that he has kind of like the stupid man's understanding of, you know, the saying like, this guy is a really stupid man's idea of a smart guy. Well, that's kind of Peter Zion. Like he sort of looks at history and then he looks at like one or two things and he says, well, this thing is similar to these other things. So that means it's the same. And again, the thing one has to realize about Zion is that he's also kind of clever in that he understands what his audiences want. Like he is basically a court jester for the American Empire. And his job is to say that the American Empire is going to be like the only empire in human history to last forever. And if he doesn't say that, he gets fired. Like he's not going to get fined a lot of business. So he doesn't. Like the U.S., sure, it has a bunch of navigable rivers, fine. I think that on the other hand, the U.S. has, on balance, I would say that like if we have a category where it's like natural resources or, you know, benefits coming from nature, the U.S. is actually in the red, not in the black. Why? Because the state of Arizona fucking exists to begin with. A state where you have all of this construction and it's all dependent on basically depleting the groundwater. And once the groundwater is gone, everyone is either going to move like, you know, the Oklahoma Dust Bowl, except 10 times worse, or they're going to stay and they're going to die from dehydration in like a week. So you have that problem. You also have the problem with like the U.S. is just really, really, really big. And how has it solved it? Has it solved it by building trains? No, not really. It has solved it by this insanely expensive and large highway system and the private automobile. And Americans love to say, well, you know, that's what separates us from the Euros. Like you people, you don't really have like autobahns like we do. And, you know, fine, point taken. It's just that like, the hangover from that, once you can no longer afford to sustain the massive, you know, car-dependent infrastructure, you don't actually get, like, you know, a massive train rail network for free mailed to you as a consolation prize. You have to build that sort of stuff at a point where you probably don't have the resources to do so because you have your hands full just repairing all of these collapsing highway bridges. And you already see this playing out in like North Carolina, for example, where I don't know which highway it is specifically that's been sort of screwed by Hurricane Helene. But it's one of the more important ones, I've been told. And like that highway, like it's never getting repaired probably. Just like that bridge in Baltimore is probably never getting repaired. Like the current ETA is like 10 years or something. But I mean, the Russians would have built that bridge in 6 months. The Chinese would have built it in 6 days. The Americans can't even build it in 6 years. It's like 10 years, but maybe it's going to be 20 years. Who knows? So like, I tend to think that like the structural disadvantages of the U.S. where like you have all of this path dependencies on like really stupid decisions that are going to impose massive costs, like relocating people from Arizona, relocating people from Nevada, relocating people from California, adjusting to a future where a lot less Americans are going to be able to afford like the private automobile. All of that is imposing costs on the U.S., which weren't really imposed on the Soviet Union when it collapsed. The Soviet Union was actually far more robust in like in terms of, how do I put this? Like having margins for error, having resiliency, having like resilient production chains and stuff like that, that the US doesn't. So I don't really have a very optimistic view of, like, I think there's going to be a period similar to what happened in the Soviet Union, like in Russia in the 90s and early 2000s. But if that lasted for 15 to 20 years for the Russians, I think Americans are going to have to expect like 25 to 40 years or 45 years even of pain.
I was going to ask you, what do you think is like the most applicable historical parallel for the U.S. at this moment? You think it's the Soviet Union?
Well, kind of in some sense. But I do think that, like, the Soviet Union, again, it was, I mean, it didn't last, but it was in some ways built to last in a way in which America isn't. And so, like, if you think about, just to take one example here, if you look at a picture of a street view in from, you know, Philadelphia or whatever, in like 1910, it looks just like an American city or sort of European city. Like you have all of these cable cars. So you have all of this public transit. Like these cities are basically built to be walkable, built to be so like workers can get to work without a private automobile. And the unique thing about America is that, like, if we have something like this in Sweden, like a cable car network, the chances of that being removed are close to zero. Because, hey, like, it works, it's cheap. Like, yeah, okay, people can afford not to use it now, but who knows what's going to happen? Like, better save the cable car network for a rainy day, right? That never happened in America. Like, all of that stuff got, you know, taken out, sold for scrap. And now, you know, those cable cars would be really useful for Zoomers who can't really buy a used car for $50 or whatever the boomers once did. But it's all gone. And there's no way of putting it back. It's literally impossible. So again, like the Soviet Union was another one of these like normal countries where if you had a cable car network, or a streetcar, whatever, like you would never, ever, ever take that away. And so when they collapsed, they had a lot to fall back on. America is quite unique in that sense, and not in a good way either, where it's like the collapse is going to be far more far-reaching because there really isn't a plan B. And if you doubt me when I say there isn't a plan B, you know, go to Google and put in the name California. And, you know, the stories you're going to be getting from the state of California are going to be pretty indicative of, like, this being a plane without any parachutes on it, put it that way.
But that's a very somber note to end on, but as always, Malcolm, you bring some very sobering insights, and that cannot be said about a lot of pundits. So before we part ways, where can listeners of the Barnes Review follow your latest works?
Mostly at Unheard, but the next issue of American Affairs Journal is going to have a fairly long essay by me on the state of the U.S. military and sort of some of the themes we discussed earlier. So those are the two places I can recommend, like American Affairs and Unheard primarily. Sometimes I write for the New Statesman as well, I suppose.
I'm really looking forward to that. And thank you again for taking time out of your day, and keep up the good work, man, because you really added some valuable contributions to this space.
Yeah, thank you. And until next time, which probably won't be that far in the future,
given
how things keep getting going from bad to worse.
Indeed, indeed. And also to our audience, thank you for tuning in. for the Barnes Review History Hour. This is Jose Nino signing out.